With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the Punch Fight. It's time for the Punch Fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England pound.
Hi, how's it going, and welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood, I'm the Editor-in-Chief at Video Week, and in this episode I'm speaking to Thomas Bremond. Thomas is the Chief Revenue Officer for FreeWheels International Business. Thomas is somebody I've known for many years now. I think he'll be a familiar face to many people listening to this. He's also been an opening act on the New Video Frontiers stage a number of times. We discuss how Thomas got into the industry in the first place, how FreeWheel has evolved over the years, the challenges faced by broadcasters and how they're going about solving them, whether TV quality content gets the credit it deserves in the advertising space, and the TV industry's relationship with social networks. A little bit of housekeeping from us first. Next up, we've got the Video Week Villa in Cannes. So if your company would like to be involved there, we'll be hosting sessions on the future of video and TV and everything that goes on within that space. Retail and commerce media. We've got a new event called Commerce Connect, which will be taking place at the Video Week Villa. And we're going to also be looking at the future of AI and the impact that that's going to have on everyone. Also, if your company hasn't entered the European Video Awards, if you're listening to this before May the 3rd, 2024, you still have time to get an entry in. Also, we're working on two guides, the Video Advertising Guide and the CTV Advertising Guide for North America. So do get in touch if you'd like to be involved with either of those. You can get in touch via the Video Week site or partnerships at videoweek.com. Now, I'll cross over to my chat with Thomas, and I hope you enjoy. So, Thomas, finally, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Vince.
Or how do you pronounce your name in a French accent? I'm sure it's a lot sexier than my Irish bastardization of your name.
It's Thomas is
Thomas, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's when people say is it Vincent, when people say
Vincent, yeah, I like that too. That works for you.
Yeah,
that works
on it feels far too sexy for me when it's in the French accent. Okay, so I'm curious. Yeah, one of the things I've been asking a lot of people is, you know, their entry point to the industry. I think there's usually an interesting story about how we ended up here. I've yet to meet anyone who dreamt of being an ad tech executive when they were 5 years old, but maybe this will be a first. But yeah, how did you get involved in the first place, Thomas?
Yeah, I mean, I love that question because I'm sure you've heard many a different tale on this one. But for me, I didn't come dreaming of being in ad tech, although it has become a fun industry to be in. But I started in finance, out of all places, and more specifically in commodities trading for a company which is sort of many people will remember the early 2000s as being very ill-fated, called Enron. If you recall that one, that was a sort of not a very fun time, but you know, one that has become very synonymous with some of the things that had gone wrong with corporate shenanigans. But clearly, of course, as you can imagine, I was not involved in those. I was very junior and at the time. But what it did teach me was sort of how markets and trading function, which has been very helpful in ad tech. And so from there, what was really interesting is I, you know, started in commodities trading, so gas, power in the U.S., and then I moved to London. But then I don't know, many people don't know the story, but Enron at the time had, was big into trading sort of large commodities, but had this idea as the internet was coming around that it would start trading bandwidth. And so the same way you would trade, megawatt hours coming out of power plants, you'd trade bandwidth, sort of megabits per second, for nascent video services on the internet. And I thought, wow, that's great. I mean, this is this great new industry. I can apply my trade in commodities trading and move to a new thing that's clearly going to boom. So I was very excited. And one of the first projects that I was assigned to was, of course, when you're trading anything, your goal is to effectively run as much of something through the pipes, right? And to sell the capacity on the pipes. And so one of the first things that I was assigned to was trying to make a VOD service, a VOD service, work between a company then known as Blockbuster at Enron. So talk about two companies that have now been very synonymous with sort of either poor timing or not turning around the corner quick enough. But they actually had something which was, you know, we're talking 2000, 2001 here, and creating the first VOD service with Blockbuster and Enron. And so here I was sort of trying to, you know, make a number of things work. But, you know, obviously, I won't go into the details of why that didn't work. But it was very interesting to see that as early as then, companies that were, quite frankly, not in the best shape were already thinking about how to make it in media and how to reinvent themselves in different paths. And so that was my story. Of course, then Enron went bust. But that particular piece of technology sort of always sort of, you know, gathered my attention. And I was like, well, this is really a great application of bandwidth. If we could deliver content across pipes, wouldn't it be much faster than at the time was like shipping tapes or not even shipping DVDs? I mean, Netflix wasn't even around then. And so I started a business with a few other fellows from France Telecom, Orange, and our strategy or our thesis was simple, that big content producers such as the Hollywood studios wouldn't need to ship tapes or 35 millimeter prints around the world now that the internet was there and now that connection to the other side of the world was much easier. And so we built this network that enabled, you know, NBC, Fox at the time to deliver their TV shows across the globe with the press of a button, and therefore saving cost, being more privacy secure by not, you know, having to ship these very expensive films before the releases into random territories. And so that became a great little, very niche, as you can imagine, little company, but that went super well. I mean, you know, at the time we're talking about, you know, companies like TF1 or the BBC, they hired people in LA to record the shows every week, and they would ship in a box, you know, these VHS tapes back to London or Paris for the executives to watch what was being aired on TV in the US. I mean, we think this is ludicrous, but that was happening, you know, in my lifetime, and God knows I'm old, you know, Vince. So that was the 20 years ago, the situation. So then when that company got bought, at the time, you know, some people had built the same system in the US to deliver TV ads, right? So imagine you use the press of a button, one ad, deliver that across all the US stations. And they said, well, why don't we start that internationally? Why don't you join us to create that service here? And now, you know, it's common knowledge and it's common, you know, it's pretty common. And, you know, you have companies like Peach and AdStream that do that across the world. But it was digital delivery of ads for a company called DG, Fast Channel. And then that company merged with MediaMind, which, if you recall, was sort of one of the first agency ad server, you know, competing with Google and sort of Flash Talking at the time. And so they merged, so that TV division and the online division. That was great because it got me really into the world of what was then true ad tech as we know it today. And it was super exhilarating getting to just really discover online and advertising. And then sort of 10 years ago, almost the day, when FreeWheel was being acquired by Comcast, it literally called up and said, you know, would you want to start our international division for FreeWheel? And then, you know, at the time, video was sort of emerging, but not really as prevalent, as common as today. So having a video ad server that was dedicated to publishers that came from a TV background was extremely niche, but I think it was the right time because people were, you know, all evolving their business model to all of these online platforms. So we kind of caught the right moment in markets to build our European presence over the last 10 years. And, you know, as you know, we've been super grateful for the success we've had and the partnership we've had with a lot of the broadcasters around Europe. So yeah, in a nutshell, that's how I got into ad tech and, you know, how I stayed there, because that's easy to get in, but not easy to always stay in ad tech.
Well, I'm glad you found a more stable career path than your the early days. Yeah, it's quite interesting actually what you're saying about the you know, recording TV shows in LA and posting them over. You were saying 20 years ago. I heard from somebody about 2 years ago who has a cloud video service, and they were finding that police services were demanding their services, because what they've been doing, if they wanted to share, say, CCTV evidence, you know, between, you know, one police station and another, or another department, what they were doing is burning DVDs,
yeah,
and then paying for a taxi to take the DVD to another police station. And yeah, I think it's very easy to forget, you know, that we live in our little tech bubble and we take these things for granted, but a lot of the world still hasn't moved on.
Yeah.
I'm curious about, you know, you've been with FreeWheel for quite some time now. I can remember the exact first time I met you and came into your office.
Yeah.
And, you know, since then the company's exploded. There was a few of you at that point. And since then the company's grown exponentially. You've been through acquisitions, all sorts of industry changes. So, you know, how has the company changed since you joined, and how has the sort of product evolved?
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating, really. As you said, we've gone from sort of being two or three here in Europe to probably what is now sort of over 300 folks and dedicated to just, you know, video proposition. So it's been fascinating to see just within our company, but also externally, as you say, like what we've been through. But so when I stepped in, right, 10 years ago and you know, was asked by Comcast and FreeWheel to kind of help build this company here, it was all about creating something that was unique for video, right? Because you already had ad servers. I mean, you know, DoubleClick had a publisher proposition, yet other specific ad servers that had come in, but they'd all come from the world of display, right? And so if you think about display, it's very momentous, right? So you have to present something to somebody at that time, at that very moment. And so I think what really got FreeWheel a lot of traction in the US first and here is because we came in at the very beginning with a proposition that said, hey, you know what? Video is over a stream. So you have to keep in mind that somebody's going to be watching something for 60 minutes or 48 minutes, whatnot. And you need to create an experience that is not the same as hey, here's a banner that you could click to get to somewhere. But it really has to be relatively seamless, both technically and it's in terms of what the ad that you showcase. So that was our first thing. It's like, hey, make a product that effectively insert an ad in a stream without screwing up the ad experience, without making the user leave the program when they're faced with an ad break that, you know, could see the same ads three times or could be 5 minutes long. And so solving for some of that was phase one of our history, call it the first 5 years, making something that was really solid for video. Then the next 5 years is, okay, well, we're hearing about this term in display called programmatic. And what does that mean for video? And so that's at the time, as you say, like our first sort of big acquisition was buying Sticky Ads, which had sort of done this at relative scale for video. But we said, look, we need to get ahead of the curve here because this is going to come. This is automation. And if you recall, like at the time, a lot of people were saying, well, never in TV, like never for video, because, you know, you're going to see the same ad three times. You're not going to be able to manage the ad experience. And so we were very cautious. I mean, because of what I said before, our priority was still managing that. So kind of brought in Sticky Ads, learned a lot about what that product did. And finally, sort of around 2019, 2020, we released kind of our unified ad server and programmatic tool. So I want to say like phase two of the industry, if you take like 2010 to 2015, is really sort of making video at scale work on all these new devices. So technical offering. Then second is the event of, you know, how do you monetize all your channels of demand and how you connect, how do you automate that? And that was really the event of programmatic. And then really since, you know, COVID and sort of that period or the last 3-4 years, it's been really about connecting everybody. So the main ask that I see around from most of my publishers, and it's not everybody, but everybody that is a broadcaster today or that's launching a fast service or is launching on CTV, is help me connect with as many people on the demand side as possible seamlessly, and help me understand all of my distribution channels, because there's new sort of a connected TV ecosystem. So you have, you know, the Samsung, the LGs, and all of the new devices that are coming, the new set-top box. So this period now that we're in right now is really what I would call interoperability. And that's really the best I can describe it. I think we're going to get to a phase that's really different. We could talk about it in a little bit when we get sort of futuristic future view. But right now we're still trying to solve, what does it take to solve the path of 100 vendors on the buy side, 100 platforms in the middle, and at the end of the day, a user that presses play and that wants to see a seamless experience. And so I think that that's where we are from a purely product standpoint. And then of course, like, we, you know, broadcasters have changed massively, but, you know, that's a very different story.
So, and then, you know, culturally with the, you know, Comcast acquisition, with, you know, you're part of this big, large Comcast family. I mean, how's the relationship work with those? Or, you know, the perception I get is that as an outsider, it feels like, you know, appear to me to be fairly autonomous in terms of what you're doing. But yeah, what's it like to be part of that, a larger group?
I mean, it's a super interesting question when you talk about, you know, being part of a larger group. And I think a lot of people have not done very well at this. I think Comcast, the benefit of being part of Comcast is it's a very patient company, right? It's not driven. I don't think it lives on the same timeline as a lot of these other companies. And let me explain why. So because for the first, I want to say 6-7 years, Comcast really didn't pay a ton of attention to FreeWheel. It said, look, you're still in your build phase. We'll come back and sort of talk about advertising when it really matters. And then around 17, 18, 19, really the pandemic, advertising really started to matter. Comcast, one, because, you know, Peacock was launched, right? And so Peacock was launched sort of at the tail end of the pandemic. And that obviously was a big corporate effort on the NBC side, which was really supported by, you know, the video solutions that Comcast creates that use the Sky player. And then so all of a sudden, everybody said, oh, but we have FreeWheel and they power a lot of this advertising that comes into these platforms. Maybe that's an underappreciated asset. So let's see what's there. And so we started to really come into the group and you know, look, Comcast is between our local ad sales business called Effective in the US, which isn't here, but it's a, you know, how to resell the ad, the 2 minute per hour to make it simple, that the networks give back to the operator in the US, and Effective sells that, the aggregate of these 2 minutes plus the digital inventory. And NBC, I mean, advertising is a big revenue line at Comcast. And so all of a sudden, you know, FreeWheel, the realization came that FreeWheel powered a lot of those businesses and helps, in a way, those businesses remain very competitive. And same with Sky when Sky came into the group. And so all of a sudden there was this realization that, you know, advertising was important. And I'll tell you, the second moment was when everybody on the SVOD platform started to introduce advertising or talk about advertising. So, you know, when Netflix first came to us and said, you know, can we talk about advertising? I mean, we know they ended up going for Microsoft, but it really was a moment in time when you could see the management at Comcast say, oh, hang on a minute, maybe, just maybe, all these SVOD platforms are going to introduce an ad tier. And maybe that the ad tech that powers these ad tiers is going to become an important asset for us to have. And so you can imagine how that's grown within the company in importance strategically as an asset of the group, but also as an asset that helps the ecosystem grow. And I know you've heard me say this a number of times at every single forum that you and I have presented together. But if Comcast said, you know, FreeWheel, the success of FreeWheel is secondary to the success of the audiovisual, the TV industry, or the premium video industry, I think Comcast would be fine with that statement, right? Yes, of course, we all want FreeWheel to be successful as far as, you know, we're concerned at Comcast. But if it said, you know, making the business grow as a result of the advance that FreeWheel has done in the past, I think that would be a very acceptable statement. So, yeah, to answer your question, we are, you know, it feels like we've become a much more enabler of different business models in the group. And that definitely feels very, very, very good to be part of that.
You know, we're using the word broadcaster here quite a bit. And it's increasingly a word that doesn't really sit right with me, particularly as we see many of those companies, you know, going all in and committing their futures to digital delivery or, you know, completely new digital models. I mean, what does that mean anymore? You know, that word, you know, what does it mean to be a broadcaster in 2024? I mean, even for us internally, we used to have a very, you know, okay, we've got this portion of TV attendees and these are the publishers.
Yeah.
And the lines have blurred so much, it doesn't really mean anything to us anymore. And we're kind of increasingly bundling together and saying media owners who, you know, but yeah, what does it mean to you?
I think that's a very fair call. I mean, I'm not going to name them, but one very large broadcaster in this region, you know, who I was meeting with the other day, said to me, you know, stop calling us a broadcaster, we're a streamer. And it really sort of, I didn't dispute it right now, and I don't want to dispute it with them, but I think it's a pivot that is necessary. It's a pivot I think is starting to sink in with a lot of the key broadcasters, as you call them today, and those that have paid a lot of money for distribution, for content rights, and this inherent sort of legacy infrastructure, which, by the way, I mean, is still a very relevant point of discussion. I mean, you look at France, for example. I mean, you know, there's right now an ongoing discussion around the TV license, right, that people still have to pay their digital license to be able to broadcast on free-to-air television in France. And they have to renew these for five years at a time. So they are, whether they want it or not, they're still putting a lot of money in the infrastructure and the acquisition of these licenses to be able to air into people's home with just an antenna or anything. So there is that kind of historical part, which makes them sort of very much attached to this legacy infrastructure. But at the same time, as you rightfully call it, they have to live in a world where their competition doesn't necessarily pay for content, doesn't necessarily care about content that goes on their platform, has generally vertically integrated with tech, so is much more agile, and doesn't have this whole very legacy infrastructure that they have to support. And so, yes, you're right. It's almost like they're operating as two separate companies very often. And I think it's both great because it allows them to be nimble, but I think it's also putting aside something that's very powerful still today, which is how do you use linear to create strength in digital. It's not that straightforward, and I think a lot of people have not necessarily manage that, but I think a lot of people are trying to optimize this workflow. So to shortly answer your question, I think what it means to be a broadcaster today is continuing to invest into broad reach and mass audiences, which is still a very valuable asset, and continuing to create programming that is well suited for live and what, you know, bringing people together around the stream. But at the same time, because this is really where our growth is coming from, of course, is investing massively into very sort of state-of-the-art user experience on platforms. I mean, you know, ITVX is a very successful extension of a broadcaster platform. You know, TF1 Plus in France is a very successful extension of a broadcaster platform, even, you know, sort of a month and a half after its launch. And so they can do it. The question is, will they have enough time? That's the key question.
You know, you guys have been, you know, you've been there at the vanguard, really, when it comes to moving broadcasters over to digital and you know, investing in their, you know, CTV services, or their, sort of cross-platform video. But, you know, we are seeing many of them go through a particularly painful and difficult time at the moment. And, you know, my first inclination in this situation is to say what went wrong, which is, you know, it's a typical journalist thing to do. But that's, you know, is there anything, I'm trying to think of more positive examples of things that went right, or, you know, cause there have been, you know, in spite of all this doom and gloom and, you know, there's bigger strategic structural issues coming into play. But there are some fantastic people who've been really trying to do really pioneering stuff, often against the odds. I'm curious about particular broadcaster products or initiatives that you think have really delivered.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few, but let's start somewhere, which is, look, TV is still a fantastic medium, and I think people are right to continue to invest in TV. Unfortunately, the economics of TV are geared against TV for a number of reasons, but one, you know, the credit, it doesn't get enough credit is more what I said, because, you know, TV brand builds, we know that, but TV is also performance, but doesn't get the credit for performance, right? If you, I think somebody said this at one of the conferences, it might be one of yours, but the word performance, you know, whoever credited digital with that was, you know, genius, and also was really devastating for TV, because it pitted TV against something that it does very well, but just has never been able to clearly measure itself. And so it's creating these massive, advantage for a lot of platforms who can measure the last click and who can measure, you know, things that are happening in the last mile. And so I think TV's unfairly been misjudged by being just a brand building initiative versus a performance initiative, when it creates the massive amount of performance engagement and metrics, but it just hasn't been able to justify itself from that perspective. So if you're asking me, like, yeah, there's definitely a positive, is that it has created all this, and it has created a lot of this last mile to realize that, you know, performance isn't just about you know, an ad on a web page or you know, something along those lines, but it does create that upper funnel to lower funnel. But it's not been able to do it well enough, right? It's not being able to get enough credit for it. That's that kind of point number one. And it's not been able to do that very often, because a lot of the companies doing performance are very vertically integrated and don't have the sort of same thing to carry as TV. Now, okay, we'll probably solve that and make sure that gets considered. I think people are trying to see that now. The second thing is, on very positive note, is, again, the audience shift is happening, but it's going from an environment where TV, in order to compete in TV, you had to set up these infrastructures, right? It wasn't given to everybody. There were rules. There were plan to observe and things to, you know, report back to government entities, to shareholders that said, you know, this is our objective, and then this is our public serving, or our the idea behind our very nature is to do this, and this is how we got our license. you know, none of these exist in digital. And so that's enabled these platforms to come in and be very aggressive and very frankly, lead with tech, which has been very important. I think broadcasters, you know, haven't embraced tech quickly enough. It's a little bit of a misnomer because they are now finally catching up, and I am selling tech to broadcasters. So, but I think the ability that tech provided around things like data, around things like automation, you know, could have been embraced a little quicker. And therefore, you know, you would have created a much more attractive proposition to agencies, you know, a while ago. And now we're sort of playing catch up. If you're a broadcaster and you're saying, well, hang on, I've got this great platform that I'm launching, which is, you know, my online platform, which is going to have everything and it's going to be bringing all the audiences together. But it's about reclaiming the spend from these brands who are used to spending on digital platform now. And they've made it easy and they've made it very straightforward to spend. And if you're a junior trader at an agency, it's very easy to press the buy digital platform, you know, buy the digital platforms like a YouTube, like a Facebook. So I think, unfortunately, the ease of buying is something that we often talk about, but is completely underestimated as one of the main factors, but it is something that TV could have done a little quicker. Look, the recent launch, I mentioned ITVX a little earlier, TF1 Plus, you know, M6 Plus is coming later. There's a number of initiatives, you know, Mediaset's doing great things as well. You know, Channel 4 have been a pioneer. That's the right angle, but you're competing with a lot more players, and so how do you capture that attention when you're no longer the leading player in market? It's about creating scale, and that's, you know, to me where TV has to go now.
I am interested to see what happens with Freely. For those who don't know, it's a joint initiative, or it will be a joint app with the some leading UK broadcasters, BBC, ITV, and Channel 4, and you know, I think there could be others added as well. But I do feel like that's very much the right direction to be heading, where ideally it should be your first port of call when you sort of turn on a TV, rather than I think when you. You're standing on your own and you're competing with massive global giants with huge resources and a new show every other day. It's very difficult for any local player at the moment. What if I was to parachute you in as CEO to say, let's take whatever the median European broadcaster looks like, you know, maybe a, you know, CTV app that's, you know, all right, maybe it could be better, maybe still highly dependent on linear revenues. What would be your first strategic steps if you were sort of able to go in and wave a magic wand and shake things up?
It would have to be around this idea of building scale, right? TV, or any platform for that matter, is really successful when it becomes the single destination for anybody, right? You're saying, I have everything for you here and you don't need to go somewhere else, which is why, you know, YouTube's been so successful. Is it has a lot of data and it has a lot of audiences and it's made easy. So the first thing is, you know, if you're a CTV platform, and some of them have done very well, you know, you take a look at what Paramount's done, you know, with both its SVOD assets and its Pluto assets, is creating a very broad scope of content offering. And that creates scale from a platform perspective that is relatively unmatched in a lot of markets. You know, on a global basis, there's 40 plus countries or plus territories where they are present. They've built a lot of scale through the right partnerships, both distribution and ad sales, if I'm very honest. And then they've now created this very sort of easy to buy, you know, scenarios with, you know, started in the US and now it's being rolled out. But in a way, the simplicity of it, the aggregation of it has to be what everyone thrives for today, because and sometimes, you know, this the scale will be going through aggregation of content that's not yours, and that's also a very powerful initiative. I see a lot of CTV players or other people who are becoming very good at aggregating third-party content and making it and packaging it with their own, which gives them both breadth of inventory type and scale type, as well as depth in terms of who they can go to and the importance they have at the agency. So I think it's a very, you know, it's a dual question of scale and simplicity. So if I were, again, leading any of these platforms or leading any of these broadcasters in their transition, I would say, yes, of course, you know, our content is our content because it makes a, you know, makes more money in theory, and we have, you know, we have the mandate. But how do I use the scale in what I've built as a cornerstone of the market in order to aggregate the content? I mean, there's no reason for me that Netflix would ever look to build their own sales team in 25 plus countries. They should rely on, you know, the local teams that have sold video at scale for a very long time. Maybe they'll do it. But I would go and actively pursue this kind of partnership strategy to build scale for my platform. And to be fair, I mean, this is something Sky has done very well. You know, Sky has built a very strong partnership where it aggregates a lot of other supply, which give them a much bigger position in market than they would have otherwise representing just the Sky channels.
On the question of, okay, I suppose we have sort of maybe drifted slightly into some negative territory already, but you know, one of the things I've heard, and you, I'm sure you hear it all the time too, is that there's often these, you know, digital departments, and over the years they've been hamstrung by, you know, combination of culture, you know, legacy technology or legacy practices. And I'm just curious, you know, do you think, you know, is this all breaking down now at this stage, you know, and, you know, do you think the right people are in place at broadcasters, and are they capable of, you know, rebalancing the ships, or is it going to require, you know, new talent to be brought in, or maybe higher more priority and focus given to the digital focused teams?
I don't think it's necessarily broken. I don't think we don't have the right people, but I think it's probably an evolution of the mindset, right? It's look, we're all human, so I'm not laying blame here, but there's definitely now a realization. So I'm not saying something that's not new, that you know, embracing sort of tech and embracing, as you call it at the beginning, you know, you have to be all in. And whilst TV is still a very significant source of revenue, and let's not dismiss that because it will be for a significant amount of time, it's all about, okay, let's spend every single moment of the day to try and create these new experiences for consumers and new ways to sell it and new ways to stay very relevant within the agencies. And, you know, I think, you know, I see that now more than anything at some of these very traditional broadcasters, that there is a moment in time where, in a way, you know, you, and either it's come with a change of management or a change of CEO, but they're coming in and saying, look, we have no more time. Let's do it. We have to do it now. We have to evolve now. And it's a fair enough statement. I think the realization is that the, you know, last results have seen TV decline massively. But at the same time, you know, the pace at which their digital business is growing is massive, but it's just not starting from a big enough base. So that's the entire way now, is you have to grow the pie so that these impressions become not just 10 or 15% of your overall audience, but how do you make them 50%? How do you unlock, you know, a linear stream into an impression stream? How do you create more eyeballs onto these online platforms. You know, this is the key. Like, you could do whatever you want to try and increase the value of a CPM, and, you know, like, there's a lot of ways to do that. But the first order of business, if you think about, you know, the 1-2 punch strategy, it's got to be about building more audiences that you can sell as premium video, whether it's by shifting over your audiences that used to be linear into your platform, whether that's by acquiring more digital audiences, or whether it's by accelerating the transition of your linear views into digital from a purely technical standpoint, making all of those more addressable and selling and measuring those as impressions. You know, those are three keys that ultimately, before you start saying how much the pie is worth, you have to grow it.
And when it comes to, you know, what one of the ways that they can grow the pie, or in theory at least, is by sort of boosting their distribution, and one of those options is the social networks, which have always had a fractious relationship with the TV industry, I think. Do you think the social networks are, you know, trusted, you know, partners and sort of valuable distribution platforms, or, you know, is the threat that they pose ultimately just too great, and maybe TV should have its own little sort of,
I mean,
you know, long form silo?
I don't think it's a question of silo. I think it's a question of distribution model. You said it, you know. If there's the right incentive to put content and rightfully remunerated in those platforms, then that's definitely an avenue that shouldn't be discounted. Unfortunately, right now, you know, for anybody that produces really top end programming, putting long form programming on a social platform that is only going to remunerate you from an ad perspective, where you compete with much shorter time frame and shorter usage, that's probably not a super appealing proposition, right? Now, from a promotional aspect, or from a, bring a user from an experience from, a digital platform or social media platform onto your main platform, then absolutely. Should that be used as a promotional tool? 100%. As a distribution tool where you're hoping to get the same ARPU as your own platform, probably not.
Yeah, it's a dilemma. It's not something I judge people for, whether they go one way or the other. It's I don't think there's any straightforward, easy answer. And
it's not. But when you think about it, Vince, you have. I mean, at the end of the day, we're and this is why I spoke about ARPU at the big, you know, just now, is that is the single biggest metric, right? If you are acquiring or producing an hour worth of content, what is the return over time of that hour of content, and how do you make it, right? I don't have the data. I presume that it exists a number of broadcasters, but when you combine sort of the various windows of exposure and their revenue model, you have a relatively clear view. I simply do not know, for a long form program that is heavily, you know, commission produced and delivered by on any of these top end platforms, even, and I'm not limiting this to the broadcaster, but I'm even saying, you know, on a Netflix or an Amazon, these are the similar type of shows. What is the model that would say, yes, it makes sense to put this on a social media platform? What is the, you know, how many views? What is the economic breakdown of that activity? I don't know that it's right now a viable proposition for anyone.
Yeah, I think another issue is simply, you know, trust over the long term. You know, if you are investing in building out your audience on a given platform, and then, you know, once a week of an algorithm, or, you know, a shift in strategy, or a new CEO comes in and decides to shake things up, all of a sudden, you know, you're in a difficult position. Whereas I feel like the TV industry has a long history of relatively stable. You know, occasionally they fall out and have their little fights, but it always they always seem to come back together, because there's a mutual interdependence, and I don't think every platform necessarily feels that way. Let's say that much. So if you had 10 million to invest, maybe you do. Where would you invest it, and why? It can be company or sector. Can't be Comcast, or
no. Well, I mean, there's a few things that I love. I'm not going to go down the easy route and say, yep, it's AI, it's machine learning, because, you know, probably for another time. And I think we're just seeing that the sort of very beginning of that as it relates to our industry. I really like the ability that, you know, the OEMs and the new entrants in the market that are sort of being very active in creating these new viewer experience. I think FAST was is a very interesting sort of moment in time. You know, if I go back 20 years ago, when I first started in the media industry, FAST used to be called Network in a Box, right? So, you know, back in the day, you'd go in and spend a lot of money in distributing your channels over satellite. There'd be huge, you know, centers or a broadcasting center. They still exist, but, you know, the channel is much more packaged with the help of ML and you know, to kind of create the right customized experience. But I do think that at some point we're going to move to another user experience with the help of tech that's going to help us package a much more curated experience, even sort of more advanced than FAST. So I think if you said to me, you know, go and test any business model out there, I'd probably scout the market for people who are building user engaged programming model that will bundle advertising, subscription based on your platform, based on your usage, based on the moment in time, based on your mood, based on what you know you're used to see. So again, I think we were, and this is very exciting because again, there's nobody that's better at doing this than TV companies, right? They know a lot about catering to human attention. So I think they missed a little bit the FAST moment, right? Like, yeah, sure, Paramount bought Pluto and, you know, Comcast bought Zumo, and there's been a number of others. But I think that was something where the TV companies should have said, maybe, just maybe, with all the content that we have, we could create a separate tier for other, you know, another type of viewer experience. I don't know. I'm not, you know, sitting here saying I know what that next user experience is, but I certainly want to find out what it's going to be. And I do think that's a great opportunity for TV companies to really start thinking about that.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I completely agree. You don't quite get that sense of, I mean, particularly when it comes to time, you know, mood at a certain time. I think that's something that TV schedulers, you know, Antiques Roadshow is, you know, shown on a Sunday typically because there's something about it that's wholesome. It's sort of family friendly. It's got that Sunday vibe to the show. I don't think that's just because it's been shown on Sundays. I think that's it's the nature of the content. And I haven't really seen in CTV environments people really getting that right, where I don't feel like the typical Sunday fare, you know, or Saturday night type content is necessarily being surfaced to me. Certainly not at a device level, whatever about is going on within certain apps. I'm sure certain apps do, but
no. I think you're right. The other thing we didn't talk about too much, but is very important for TV as well, and is definitely a beacon of hope, is you know, a live environment. TV is a master like no other in that environment, in understanding production, understanding what happens in sort of the Super Bowl, Olympics, World Cup like events, who, you know, require scale but also provide massive opportunity for storytelling. And the storytelling that engaged the brands and the viewers. So, you know, right now you look at the number of lot of platforms that are launching, you know, some of them are being funded or sponsored by traditional media companies. I think, you know, you're seeing more of the new platform enter the game because they're realizing, you know, sports is definitely one of these things that is global in nature and captures attention like no other. So I think TV and the broadcaster environment is perfect for that, and they need to capitalize on it. We're seeing it day in, day out now with these new platforms, but definitely the success of broadcast remains around the shared experience that life provides.
It would be, yeah. I do feel sorry for past generation or the younger generations who don't really have that experience of everyone's come in and everyone has seen the same TV show. I mean, they probably did at school to some degree, but everyone watched some influencer's video or something like that. But
it's different, yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, at some point again, another generation has a sense that they're discovering for themselves, oh, how wonderful it is when the whole nation's pretty much, you know, tuned into this show at the same time. Maybe we'll see it come back. I don't know.
Yeah.
Thomas, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much for coming on.
As always, Vincent. Vincent.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm blushing now. That's a very sexy note to end on. Take care. Bye. Bye.